Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. On March 15, students around the world went out on strike. Inspired by 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, they walked out of class to demand meaningful and impactful action on climate change. With their futures at stake, young people are striking to call for the Green New Deal and for a fair and equitable transition to 100% renewable energy. So what is the Green New Deal and how do we shepherd it from concept to reality? Today we talk with Nicholas Caleb, staff attorney with the Center for Sustainable Economy, and Khan Pham, who's the organizing director with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, about what politicians and climate organizers mean when they talk about the Green New Deal and how we go about achieving it. Nick and Khan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Well, I think there's a lot of confusion, actually, about what the Green New Deal is. In fact, I was just reading an article. I don't remember what website it was just before I came over here. And again, like the Republicans throw a lot of obfuscation about how it's not practical, how it's a socialist nightmare or whatever. And then we hear it's almost like a litmus test for a lot of Democratic candidates now for president that you must support the Green New Deal. But I think a lot of people are confused. So what is the Green New Deal?
So the Green New Deal is a concept that, well, I would say the Oregon Green New Deal is a plan that is still in evolution, but that a statewide alliance of environmental justice, community-based organizations representing communities across the state came together just at the just in January to start to imagine what it would take for our state and our communities to take seriously the crisis of inequality and the climate crisis we face and come up with solutions that will create jobs and really will create jobs and address the adaptation that our community, the investments that our communities need to be able to adapt to a changing climate.
Is there a difference between what Oregon is proposing and the national Green New Deal that Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has proposed?
It's a little bit different in terms of how we've framed it and how our organizations have put together sort of our version 1.0, but it's within a larger context where this discussion is happening and different scales. I mean, globally, you mentioned the climate strike that happened. That seems to have reignited another round of maybe even climate negotiations to come out of it. I've even heard of some of my European colleagues talking about having a European Green New Deal. So it's an idea that's really catchy and it's inspiring a lot of people. What that's actually going to look like, as you know, that there's a resolution that's been proposed before the House of Representatives, which has a Democratic majority right now. What form that will get passed in or if it will get passed, it's unclear. There are a lot of big ideas there, but also, as you say, a lot of groups pushing back. And so for us in Oregon, we thought that it was important to take that opportunity to ask what we want and what we need as a community here to basically, as Khan said, transition away from a broken economy towards something that is going to sustain life, is going to actually help us to survive the climate crisis.
Well, actually, for those of us who are old enough, I'm not included, there was the New Deal during FDR's term. And I wonder what the connection is between FDR's New Deal and this current Green New Deal.
That's a great question. I think it's important for us to remember the conditions, the historical conditions that the U.S. was facing with the New Deal. And during the Great Depression, the U.S. was in major economic collapse, and one in four Americans were unemployed. People were migrating from agricultural land that they could no longer sustain their families. It was, you know, the U.S. was really was in turmoil. The president was really worried about even being able to maintain power. So FDR was elected on a platform to really do the impossible, to basically rescue our country from a state of economic collapse. And with that, he proposed, and his party proposed, a slate of policies called the New Deal. And that included ways to rein in Wall Street and the reckless profiteering. It created jobs for millions of people, millions of Americans, to build new infrastructure like the Golden Gate Bridge and
Timberline Lodge.
And these are benefits that we continue to benefit from investments in electricity that millions of Americans had no access to before that, the right to collective bargaining, and so much infrastructure that we still use today. So the New Deal brought structural changes that that addressed the economic roots of the crisis that they were facing. And the Green New Deal, in the same way, is about bringing structural change to address not just, you know, the climate conditions, but also the economic crisis of inequality that we face, and to build a more just society and economy.
One kind of irony about it, while the New Deal did a lot to rebuild the economy of the United States, it wasn't really conscious about the green issues. And you mentioned the infrastructure and the electricity. Well, they built a lot of dams and they destroyed major salmon runs and a lot of other ecological damage. So how does the Green New Deal factor in the environmental necessities we also need to protect and restore while we're also trying to protect and restore economic security?
Sure. But also, just before answering that, I'd like to note that there were other oversights in the original New Deal as well. Maybe not even oversights, design flaws, let's say, that emboldened basically the white working class and gave a leg up and put other people in this country, people of color and other poor people, into desperate states that actually didn't allow them to build wealth through generations. And so that's something that the new version of a New Deal, a Green New Deal, needs to accomplish as well. It needs to broadly apply to everybody in American life and uplift the communities that have been the most harmed by the current economy and will be the most harmed by climate change. So what you say about the Green New Deal is absolutely correct. People in a rush to kind of build out a new economy didn't maybe think through some of the long-term impacts of building out dams all over the place and all the rest. I think we're in a position where, because we have a lot of crumbling infrastructure here, even jobs with, say, Portland, for example, or Oregon, we are at seismic risk all over the place. And I don't know if anybody's actually put it on paper just how many billions of dollars of investment and how many years of work it would take to keep our infrastructure up to seismic code, right? I mean, so there's a lot that can be done to stimulate the economy that's not about, like, going out into nature and, you know, changing things up too much. But there's also a new ecological consciousness that's emerging with the climate crisis and with, you know, it's 40 years in the making, basically, since the early days of the environmental movement in the United States and the globe. And so this might be the first opportunity to have a clear expression of what an economy would look like. How do we transform our economy in a way that avoids those destructive practices and starts to have a more restorative and regenerative character to it?
Well, one of FDR's motivations with the New Deal was to preserve capitalism, which was really about to wither away or implode or whatever. I've talked to some people who think that the Green New Deal might be the end of capitalism and maybe looking to a post-capitalist society. So how does that, on the other hand, I just read yesterday that Elizabeth Warren is saying that she's definitely a capitalist, but she wants to remake capitalism. And I've heard other people say it better be socialism or the new Green New Deal is not going to work. So how does that factor in?
Yeah, I can take a shot at it. At least in terms of our coalition, we don't expressly come at it from a position of being anti-capitalist or having a position of socialism or anything like that. It's not our first imperative is not to think through sort of like what the ideology strain that we want to position ourselves in. It's about supporting working people, frontline communities, and communities of color, and making sure that first and foremost, we're creating an economy that protects and uplifts that sector. What that looks like and how we define that later on, it remains to be seen, but it definitely would involve wealth redistribution at a minimum, retooling
finance,
coming up with new financing mechanisms, maybe state and local banks, other community control over the energy that's produced. And so, you know, you can attach various labels to this, but we think that it would be a significant transformation of the economy.
And maybe it would be helpful to share. I didn't get a chance to share the seven main points that our current version, still a living document, includes of our Oregon Green New Deal. It calls for a moratorium on fossil fuel infrastructure expansion, 100% clean and renewable energy, clean air regulation, sustainable forests and farms, transportation policy and investments to reduce auto emissions. New funding to create provide jobs, job training, and also to help communities adapt to the impacts of climate change in Oregon, who are already experiencing the worst impacts.
Well, one of the arguments I've heard being made against the Green New Deal from conservatives is that they wonder, why are you putting economics together with environment? What do those two things have to do? And isn't that just like being all over the place and having no focus?
Yeah, there's no way to separate economics and the environment. And the paradigm that we've been living in for hundreds of years now just disguises the costs to the environment and to the public and to public health, and wraps them up into profit to make it look like there's this growth happening. But no matter what we're producing and no matter how we're doing it, no matter how we're getting our energy, we're always making choices. And just because you don't want to account for the harms doesn't mean that, you know, you're basically, we're not going to allow that to happen anymore. We're going to say that the gains and the harms have to be calculated equally.
Yeah, Kai?
And I think they want that because they don't want people to realize that this is a huge opportunity of benefit to create jobs that millions of Americans actually don't have access to currently, living wage jobs, to build the renewable energy infrastructure that we need and to weatherize our homes, and also to build the care economy that underpins and makes possible all this other labor as well. The nurses, the teachers, the home care workers, the people who provide childcare, that all enables us to be able to create this renewable economy that we desperately need to build.
Now, I've been spending a lot of time at a bunch of public hearings over the last few years around this. Well, it used to be around oil trains, and now it's around frack gas projects. And the most interesting comment I heard from all these people who are supporting the projects, who all say we need the jobs, there was somebody who came up from Coos Bay to the hearing in Salem for Jordan Cove for the permit that they were needing, which has now been postponed 6 months, but one of the many permits they need to dredge, both to dredge the harbor in Coos Bay and also to clear cut and do all the other things they're going to be doing for the Pacific Connector pipeline. And this guy talked about how important it was to save jobs. And he said, you know, people talk about protecting the environment, but I believe saving one job is more important than protecting the environment. What do we do with that mentality, basically?
Well, this is about creating thousands of jobs. I think that's what excited people about the New Deal, and I think it's what exciting people about the Green New Deal, that we don't have to make a choice, that there are opportunities if we're being equitable about the wealth that's generated, to actually share that wealth through projects and investments that are actually going to stimulate and invest in economies that have been historically disinvested in.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Nicholas Caleb, staff attorney with the Center for Sustainable Economy, and Khan Pham, organizing director with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. And we're talking about the Green New Deal, particularly Oregon's Green New Deal. So let's talk about how these jobs are going to be funded, basically, because that's another thing that's thrown out. People say, well, it's too expensive. Where's the money going to be coming from?
Well, there's a lot of funding mechanisms available to us. I'm not an expert on it, but there are a lot of discussions about what can the federal government actually spend money on, right? And what's the purpose of a deficit and how does that relate to austerity? Basically, the federal government, it's a lot harder for state governments to act on their own, but the federal government can spend to create basically whatever economy it wants to. We've got centralized banks that are able to lend and change interest rates and do discounts and all the rest. So among a lot of economists, it doesn't seem to be the big deal in the room, how we fund it. It's just more about the politics of actually making that choice. Go ahead.
Yeah, were you going to say something?
Well, I would say that they people said the same thing about the old New Deal, that it was also impossible. You know, they didn't have a budget for it before they started it. And that's the same conditions that we face.
What do you mean by they didn't have a budget?
You know, beforehand, the money wasn't already set aside for it, that they found the way because they had a political will to make and push these structural changes. They found the money when there was a political will. And in the same way, we have this moment where we're facing conditions that are actually threatening our country, I would argue even more so in our civilization. And we need to be able to make those bold moves. And the government has a critical role to play in that.
Yeah, well, there's been an argument. Well, I've heard many people say that one of the failures of the Obama administration was not going far enough in spending money to buy our way out of the Great Recession 2008-2009. and that he probably wanted to go a lot further, but he couldn't even get buy-in from the conservatives in the Democratic Party, let alone the Republicans. So how do we put that mindset, like Paul Krugman writes about this all the time. I mean, there's many progressive liberal economists who are very clear. I mean, Keynes is the example, the beginning example of that, who believe that you throw money, you put a lot of money into getting out of an economic and, in this case, environmental climate hole. How does that mindset become the mainstream mindset as opposed to the one we have right now where, well, I'm not sure. At least nobody's saying we should really throw a lot of money at the wall. And maybe that's a place where people are starting to realize, no, we have to be really careful where we throw money. But that people think that we can't spend money for things that, well, we really don't want to have happen anyway because it's not going to benefit corporations, the fossil fuel industry, and the forces that really control things.
Yeah, I mean, that example you brought up is really interesting just because of the political choices that happened at that period in our history. Barack Obama came into office with overwhelming community and national support to do basically whatever he wanted to do. And he had a Congress. We heard all this so much about like, oh, we don't have the 60 votes, but we saw what Republicans can do if they're willing to move their policy and they really are committed to doing it. But Obama brought in a lot of folks connected to Wall Street, and Larry Summers, of many notorieties, was put in a position to basically say, okay, well, this is the number economists are going to say for the stimulus that we actually need. Let's cut that in half, make it more palatable, and that'll be our starting point for the discussion. And I mean, if you're going to negotiate away before you even begin, that's not the type of politics that's actually going to win. I mean, you have to ask for what you need at this point in history. And having people say things like, oh, it's going to cost too much to avert apocalypse, that's just like such an absurd statement on its own that like anybody who says that stuff, you just should probably look at them sideways and try to understand what their priorities actually are, which are likely to protect class and privilege.
Actually, I was just thinking as you're talking, it's too bad that Obama's chief economic advisor wasn't Jared Bernstein, who was Joe Biden's economic advisor, because there was such a difference between Jared Bernstein's positions, which I think we would agree with them, and Larry Summers and Tim, who was his?
Geithner.
Tim Geithner, and these people who were all from Wall Street. We are in a much harder position right now because we have this very strange person who's individual number one. We have, I think, of the most progressive House we've probably had in my lifetime, but then we still have this Senate, which is just really dragging its feet. And I was just reading an article this morning about how it's the vast majority of Republicans still don't want to take on climate change. What is, besides having lots of young people marching in the streets, what can we be doing to really force this discussion to be on the table and for them to take it seriously?
I mean, for us, one choice that we've made is we know that we don't control Congress, or people like us don't control Congress right now. And so an area where our politicians do say that they want to act on climate are Portland, the metro area, and Oregon. And so that's why I think we're focusing a lot of our attention here to say, okay, well, whatever's on the table now, is that actually going to be adequate? And let's decide what's going to be adequate. What do people in this state actually want? What's going to create, at least at this level, the economy that's going to uplift people, and then become an example and help to raise other struggles up around the country so that we can build that momentum to get across the finish line like we need to.
Well, I'm working on this documentary right now about the frack gas projects that are trying to get a foothold across the Northwest. And I was just listening to some footage I recorded last November right after there was a big public hearing in Tacoma around the Tacoma LNG facility. It was a hearing on the supplemental environmental impact statement that was very flawed, and a lot of people were really up in arms about it. And one of the people that I was talking with a few weeks after the hearing in this little session I recorded was talking about how we have to act. We should have acted 50 years ago, first of all. I mean, we're so late that there's no time to, like, drag your feet at all anymore. But the problem is it's not just local. I mean, we have to be doing this on a global level. So how does what we do in Oregon tie into the fact that climate change is a global, it's more than a problem, a global catastrophe?
Well, I think people are looking for models, and I think that's where having local models and state models can help. And the United States, as the largest historical emitter of emissions, has to be a leader in showing how that transition happens and bear the responsibility of the number one cause of the climate crisis that we're in. And I think we're forgetting to talk about one of the clearest examples of a Green New Deal, which is the Portland Clean Energy Fund, which voters overwhelmingly passed this past November 2018.
And your organization was very involved in that, right?
Yes. This was the first community of color-led environmental initiative in the history of Oregon, and it was led by a broad coalition, including OPAL, Environmental Justice Oregon, the Coalition of Communities of Color, which includes Verde and Apano and Portland African American Leadership Forum, NAACP, both. I'm forgetting all of the organizations, but there was over 200 organizations that endorsed and supported and put in the sweat and labor hours to just knock on doors and talk to their neighbors, because we knew that we couldn't count on our leaders. The city commissioners weren't willing to take the kind of bold action that we needed. And so we started a public conversation about what it means to create thousands of green jobs while addressing the climate crisis.
One thing I was thinking about as you're describing this initiative, which we're very excited about, and it was a very historic initiative. Also, what a person who was really involved in organizing for that and was also very involved in running for city commission at the same time, Joanne Hardesty, was elected by about the same margin that the initiative passed. And so it makes me think again, especially when I spend time in communities like Longview and Kalama and Tacoma, where there's not the political infrastructure to really move forward with any kind of green thinking. In Portland, we put, I think, the first person in city council who has the moxie to really push this agenda. So how do we get more people and more communities to be in elected offices because it seems to me that this has to come not just from the grassroots, not from folks like us, but from people who actually are in positions of power to make things happen.
So Con and I both work for 501c3 organizations, so we probably won't talk too much around the direct electoral politics, but I think that you're absolutely correct that there's different levels at which this energy has to manifest itself. And so sometimes that's grassroots organizing and planning and lobbying, and sometimes that's like winning office. And we think that those things are closely related as well, that as the culture and the politics changes, then people start to find their way into power. I also would say that there's a lot of potential for political change that comes along with ideas like the Green New Deal as well. You had mentioned frack gas resistance. Last year, I spent a year in Klamath Falls, Oregon, which is my hometown, working on a variety of projects related to resisting the Jordan Cove LNG project, and also working with a tech university down there on renewable energy planning for communities. Hood River recently put together a really amazing community energy plan. There's a lot of groups in Oregon where people are taking control of their energy systems already. It's probably not data that's widely available or stories that are widely available, but this is something that people are craving in rural communities and urban communities and agricultural communities and historic forestry communities. So it really is spreading. And I think our job is to make those connections better and to build those linkages and to organize together toward bigger goals.
That's interesting, because in Portland, we can't even get a public utility district created. I mean, people have been trying to do that for about 30 years. But I also realize at the same time that community energy is really important. I'm thinking historically, like Washington State is full of public utility districts. Most of the power in Washington is public power. And I think about public power is not always good. I think about the nuclear power fiasco back in the 80s. And that now there's a big issue with public power in Washington and the fact that frack gas is coming in, even though the public power is mostly generated by dams, by hydro. So how do we, it seems like in Oregon, we need to get more public power, but at the same time, how do we create these community energy organizations that actually use renewables and are accountable to the community?
Well, I was actually just wanting to answer the question about governance that you asked earlier, because I think it is a key question in terms of how do we change our local governance. I think, Joanne, it shouldn't take somebody who is a two-term state legislator, and she is just a phenomenal, amazing community organizer, which allows her to overcome the significant barriers that currently exist for people who are accountable to communities to be able to get elected. Our current system really favors people who are more I mean, just the amount of money that you need to raise in order to be able to win city council is prohibits kind of ordinary grassroots or people to be able to be elected. And so I just wanted to echo, and I don't know, Nick, if you have an answer about the community-based renewable energy. That's the question that we're definitely...
Exactly. I'd like to sort of define what that is a little bit more so people understand the difference between that and public utility districts.
Yeah, well, utility law is almost exclusively state law in the United States. So we are already allowed as municipalities to take over the infrastructure of a whatever utility is operating your community. So there is a democratic mechanism that's available. Obviously, like, the utilities will put a lot of money into defeating those things, but it's possible. And the state can change law at the Public Utility Commission. They could make it easier. These things are much like we were talking about with the finance issue. It's not really a policy question. Like, we have a dozen tools probably that we could identify and list off. It's whether the political will exists to actually take on industry. And I'm sure that you've been reading some of the reporting coming out of the Oregonian, of all places, recently on the amount of polluter money in politics and how that's impacted the environmental movement in the state. And hopefully what the organizing that we are trying to do is to galvanize people to really overcome those structural barriers of money in politics and polluters having too much say, so that we can actually ask for what we need. So last year, the state had a Senate bill 978 process that invited a lot of communities in to think about what the future of public utility regulation should look like in Oregon. And a lot of groups that wouldn't otherwise have been able to get there were able to show up and made basically really large demands of the Public Utility Commission to ask them to consider equity in the work that they do, to actually consider climate change before they are going to legitimize a utility's integrated resource plan and all the rest. And the Utility Commission didn't ask for a lot of that, but a lot of those folks are also involved in the with the Oregon Green New Deal process. And there's actually a bill in the legislature right now, and I don't know if we want to talk about it at all, but there's like a public utility equity bill. I think it's HB 2242 that would create some structures within the Public Utility Commission to allow much greater advocacy for low income rate structure, for example, that would benefit poor Oregonians. And so these structural changes are always available to us here. And there are really creative people that are already working on it. But mostly, I think we have to build the culture and the storytelling and the connections to be able to win at the legislature when we have those ideas.
Yes, because every time, every legislature, every session, we're so excited about all these bills that never even reach the floor. And then you go, what's wrong with what's wrong with the Oregon legislature? And it's full of the Democrats, and we're still not getting anywhere. And I want to let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Nicholas Caleb, who's staff attorney with the Center for Sustainable Economy, and Khan Pham, who's organizing director with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. Well, you mentioned that article in the Oregonian, which a friend sent me the link, and so I read it, and there's some very interesting things in it that were kind of eye-opening. But I was also kind of disturbed by some of the sort of aspersions that it and some conclusions that it made. And it was comparing Washington State's environmental protection laws with Oregon's lack of them, and talking about how because of those laws and those regulatory bodies, Washington was able to stop the Tesoro Savage oil terminal, for example, in Vancouver. And I'm reading that and thinking, no, it wasn't the regulation in Washington, which is basically rubber stamping for the fossil fuel industry until Vancouver Energy was defeated. It's grassroots organizing. And that article didn't seem to factor that in. And in fact, a friend of mine in Washington, when I was telling about the article, said, well, it's really, Oregon in many ways has a lot of advantages over Washington because Oregon has much stronger land use laws. And that's what we've been using so far, which the Oregonian has been very much opposed to, actually, in many ways.
Yeah.
And that's why I see an article in the Oregonian that's criticizing, supposedly from the left, things like the fossil fuel industry. Or actually, they were saying it was timber money. That's the main thing in Oregon. In Washington, it's mainly fossil fuel money that fuels politics. And that's what has killed many good proposals in Washington. So I think that we should, instead of just kind of looking at how bad everything is here in Oregon and how much corporate money pollutes our politics, we should also be looking at our strengths and organizing from them and getting the same kinds of environmental protection regulations that Washington and Montana have and California. So I wonder how we kind of frame that and how the Oregon Green New Deal can help to frame this way of looking at how we move ahead and how we use the institutions we already have, as well as agitating for institutions that we need, that we don't have yet, to really strengthen both the environmental protection and economic and social and environmental justice.
It's a big question. I agree with your assessment in a lot of ways, and would even go further and say, I think the reason that Tesoro Savage wasn't certified is because 270,000 people involved themselves in the public comment period, which is an enormous amount of people to get involved with something like that, broke records by 10 times over for public comments in Washington. And by the time the decision reached Inslee's desk, there had been so much political resistance put up against it. It would have been political suicide for him to go above recommendations from state regulators and all the rest. Similarly, in Portland in 2016, we passed land use code to prohibit new fossil fuel infrastructure. It wasn't as broad as it needed to be, and you might be following the ARC logistics or the Zenith oil terminal discussion right now.
Let's talk a bit about that towards the end, because that keeps me up at night right now.
Yeah, so. But one thing that's true about Oregon laws is our forestry laws are miserable. They're very poor, and there are efforts happening right now. There are a couple of bills in the legislature to try to improve that, but that sector has been really dominant. I think I don't discount what you said. I think it's a strong analysis, but I also think there are probably some structural issues where if people have just access to politicians on demand and have lobbyists like in the legislature all the time, and that culture is there, politicians are just going to be more likely to turn to industry for questions or decide with their political assessment. And Rob Davis, who led a lot of this investigative research, I got to know him when he was working on the air quality bills over the last 2 or 3 years. And he also ran into a lot of frustration sort of uncovering air pollution issues all over the place, writing about it, uncovering it, seeing grassroots networks that were advocating for diesel regulation. By the way, there's a bill this session again, and clean air rules and all the rest, and being disappointed about some of those final products. So I think he's coming at it from a place of like integrity. The institution of the Oregonia, I'm generally not impressed with, but Rob Davis's reporting is quite good here, I think.
Well, I have to say that there was a lot in that article that I was very happy to see. I mean, particularly the issue around protecting and then not protecting the marble muralette. And I came to Oregon in 71, and I think it took me about 2 weeks to figure out that the timber interest totally controlled the state. And Barbara Roberts was the first person to run statewide who was not in the pocket of the timber interests in my experience in Oregon. And all of our great liberal politicians that, you know, in the forefront of progressive politics, like Wayne Morris and Tom McCall and Mark Hatfield, supposedly, they're all like cutting down the forests. So I think that that's been Oregon's real weak point, at least as long as I've lived here, and probably for 100 years before that. And so that needs to be addressed. But I guess it also seems like that kind of pollution, financial pollution of Oregon politics, kind of sprinkles into other aspects besides just the timber industry. So I also I wanted to talk a little bit about this march that happened on Friday, because I'm curious about how you see that this is maybe going to be a direction changer, and that there's a certain kind of energy coming from young people that could maybe actually influence the people who are in power right now.
You want to take that one here?
I think that the march was incredibly important. I think youth have an important voice, a critical voice, as the generation that's going to be having to live with the consequences of decisions that were made before they were born. And I think there's broad agreement that there's the urgency of it is what they're bringing, that we can't just be kind of tweaking at the edges, that we need to actually fundamentally address the root causes of what's causing the climate crisis, and focus on who's responsible, the major climate polluters that benefit and aren't paying any of the costs.
Yeah, I've been really impressed. I used to work for a group called Our Children's Trust in 2014, which listeners might know from a series of lawsuits, some state and some federal, that are trying to assert constitutional rights to a healthy atmosphere and stable climate. And their organizing has been really incredible. And then there are groups like Sunrise, who are a little bit newer, who are doing a lot of interesting work on the Hill in DC, and then some of them are starting to establish smaller groups to do more localized work. And in Portland, we've been extremely lucky to have young people involving themselves in environmental politics for as long as I've been involved. A couple of years ago, when we were debating our renewable energy policy, a group of young people came in and just demanded the creation of Youth Climate Council, and, you know, were able to win their demands by good organizing. And a lot of the resistance to Jordan Cove is involving, in Southern Oregon, is involving all sorts of youth from tribal communities, kids in Ashland and Medford and Coos Bay. And there was even an amazing op-ed written about a year ago from youth from all of the tribes in the Klamath River Basin, basically asking Kate Brown to think about their future. So, I mean, this is, like Khan said, they're setting the moral tone, and their energy is uplifting so much of the struggle. And but I'm a bit wary. I don't, like, young people are amazing. The energy is definitely needed. And anybody who's not a young person, we need to support them and help them and protect them and make sure that they're not hanging out to try. So I say at the same time, like, yes, like, support young people. And also, this should be a challenge to everybody else to get involved and figure out what kind of resources you can bring and how you can uplift those struggles and protect those kids that are putting themselves at significant risk right now.
Well, I also am interested in how they're really pointing fingers at the governors, the two green governors in the Northwest, one who's running for president now on a totally green platform that seems to leave out frack gas as part of the problem. And then Kate Brown, who I've been to many rallies where people are calling on her to take a stand on Jordan Cove. So two parts to this question. One is the way we all need to, what should our approach be to these two governors? I also wonder how we can support young people as they continue to put pressure on Kate Brown around Jordan Cove and other issues that affect their future.
Yeah, well, continue to put pressure on Governor Brown around Jordan Cove, I think, for sure. She's a major decision maker around that project. For folks that don't follow it super closely, there's a series of state permits that, as advocates, we believe that the denial of any one of them could actually lead to the project being defeated. So far, the governor's response to questions about Jordan Cove has been sort of like, I'm a neutral arbiter. My job is just to make sure that the laws are enforced correctly, and just really kind of a neutered analysis when compared to some of the other positions she's taken. So, for example, on offshore drilling, when that became an issue, even though it's completely a federal issue, as far as I understand it, she said, we'll resist, we'll stop and do whatever we can. And then when the biggest climate polluting project in Oregon's history that she actually has some control over, we get this kind of like middling answer. So there's an interesting politics there for sure. And I think our best bet is to just to continue to mobilize and put pressure on her.
Yeah, there's a great puppet that I've seen many times.
the paper mache
yeah. Kate. And then there's the Black Snake Pacific Connector Pipeline.
And in answer to your question about how to support youth, I'm speaking for Opal. We're really excited to continue to work together with the Sunrise Movement and other youth activists to do shared political education together as we build our collective analysis. I think there is such a sense of urgency, and I think necessary. And we also want to make sure that it's grounded in a real clear analysis about what the real solutions are to this climate crisis. And so I'm really looking forward to continue to build that collective analysis with youth.
Well, one of the problems with being young, because I can remember being young, and it was during the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement, and young people didn't have patience to like go through all the machinations that the establishment, our leaders, our political leaders, our elders felt like we had to do to decide on urgent questions that we saw were just like very obvious. You don't do something that's so awful. You get out of Vietnam. You give all people the same rights. There's no two ways to this. And I see this with the young people who are fighting to really save the planet now, that they see an urgency. And it's their lives, and they're the ones who are going to be suffering from the consequences of what my generation and generations ahead of before me have done. I just understand. I mean, when I think about what it's like to be young, why there's so much impatience, and so I wonder how we channel that impatience so that it can push the forces that don't want to move.
Actually, I would share that urgency and that impatience. Actually don't think there's a problem with that.
I mean, I feel the same way, too. I'm just thinking, like, to me, I still feel that way about this. And I know lots of people my age who feel just as urgent about climate change. But I think when I hear young people talk about it, I'm realizing that they're not thinking about something that's going to happen after they die. I mean, they're thinking about their young adulthood, let alone their older adulthood. And it puts a kind of pressure on that I think I'd like to see the Joe Bidens and people like that actually get it and understand the urgency that young people have.
Yeah, I think that's our role, is actually to be supporting that, the call out of, I mean, I think that Dianne Feinstein video is so emblematic of the response of moderate Democrats right now. And I think, I would say, I'm sorry, I'm blanking out a little bit, but I would actually just say that we can't, I mean, right now, what the people who think they know better are saying is that we can just depend on the market, that the cost of renewables is going down, and that we can just wait for the market, the magical hand of the market to lead us to a renewable future. And there's been studies, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology just came out with a study that said, at this rate, even with the cost of renewables going down, we can't, it'll take something like 400 years for us to transition to 100% renewable economy, and that's something that's extinction, that's collapse.
What?
And so I think I would support the call. I think it's what's important to remember is that actually indigenous communities, people of color, communities of color that have been on the front lines for decades have also been making these calls out. And so I think what we want to do in working with the Sunrise Movement and some of these some groups that have been getting a lot more media attention is to also work with them to have these honest conversations about white privilege and how it plays out in media attention. And I think I've seen really hopeful organizing by youth, for example, around Parkland youth organizers who once they realized the privilege that came from their positions, reached out to youth in Chicago who've been calling out gun violence for years, right? But in getting not even a modicum of the same kind of attention that they've been given. And so I think I'm really hopeful for the kinds of conversations that we can be having when indigenous communities and communities of color have been and calling for the urgency of this change for decades now.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today we just heard from Khan Palm, who is organizing director with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, and Nicholas Caleb, who's staff attorney with the Center for Sustainable Economy. We're talking this morning about the Green New Deal. And I guess in the last few minutes that we have here, I wanted to talk about the struggle we have in this region around getting our elected leaders, our political leadership, to recognize that as they stand up and talk about the dangers of fossil fuel, and they are always talking about coal and oil, and you mentioned a little earlier Kate Brown taking a strong stand against drilling for oil off the coast of Oregon, that somehow frack gas is not in this equation. And I wonder how we help to shift the conversation as we put together the Oregon Green New Deal, that there's two elements that are not considered bridge fuels, and one being frack gas and the other one being nuclear, because those keep getting thrown up by the industries as, oh, well, we'll use these are cleaner than coal and oil, and we'll use gas and we'll use nuclear because nuclear has no carbon emissions. And there's, to me, like a lot of, well, I think it's coming from a financial economic interest on their part that they're promoting this rather than really going genuinely towards a renewable future.
Well, everybody loves a false solution that can make some money in the interim. And if that's the one thing I've learned in politics, that's kind of what it's been. Luckily, in the Pacific Northwest, we in the grassroots environmental justice movements have a pretty mature analysis around frack gas, because we're not a fossil fuel generating region, or maybe in like a really small sense, but we've been inundated with these export projects over the last, and some for domestic energy production as well, for the last like 5 or 6 years, that people have done a lot of the research and figured out that from a carbon standpoint, gas actually isn't better than coal and oil. A lot of it because of methane leakage that takes place at the site of extraction, and methane is about 86 times more potent in the short term of greenhouse gas than CO2. And so just mathematically, a small amount of leakage is going to add up to a overall climate impact that's roughly equivalent, and maybe worse, because it spurs short-term warming. So that's an analysis that's been incorporated into law in Portland through a series of resolutions, and also the fossil fuel terminal zoning amendments, which were passed in 2016. So locally, we've sort of come to that conclusion. You can see that there. But and in this in Southern Oregon, that conclusion has been generated by a lot of groups that are fighting against the Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector Pipeline. You mentioned Tacoma LNG as well. So I think us definitely, I mean, there's no danger from Oregon Just Transition Alliance or folks working on the Oregon Green New Deal that we're going to backslide and see frack gas as a transition fuel. It's just not there. It's a dirty fossil fuel. And
we need a ban on it.
Yeah. And so for our advocacy, that's just a principle that we abide by. Like, we're not interested in sustaining a fossil fuel economy in any form.
Now, I understand with the Green New Deal nationwide, is there some hedging from certain people about whether nuclear should be included in that and what their position on gas is?
Yeah, there was a debate over whether it's about terminology that in the resolution originally referred to basically like a goal of net zero. And in kind of the details of the energy world, that can mean a lot of different things, right? That could mean nuclear, or that could mean, hydropower expansions or other things that are not necessarily going to be environmentally, ecologically, or democratically favorable, but could theoretically, technologically bring down carbon. And so there are a lot of struggles, just like with everything at DC, of various interest groups threatening to leave the table and walk away if certain things aren't there. And I think there were some choices made to try to keep that net as broad as possible for now, while there's momentum being built. In Oregon, I think we don't want to have that net where we're bringing in nuclear and gas producers, even to think that they might be a part of that. We're not going to phase out existing gas facilities or change out everybody's gas stove tomorrow. I mean, that's not something that's immediately feasible, but it does need to happen at some point. There's just the math doesn't work with having a gas infrastructure anymore, and we've got to start transitioning away from it immediately. So figuring out what that's actually going to look like at the like micro level of what are cities going to do, who the people that are actually going to be doing those transitions, what are the technologies we're going to transition to, that work is still in development, and that's the kind of stuff that we want to get involved with.
I'm just thinking in terms of short-term and long-term, because, I mean, we have this 12-year marker that the ICPP gave us last fall, and that means 12 years from now, we better not just start working on it, we better have our plan in place and be seriously reducing emissions. And then I think about decisions that, like, homeowners make. I mean, and 25 years ago, my partner and I bought a new house, and we put it, it was all gas. We switched out everything and had gas heater and stove and water heater. And about 8 years ago, I went, oops, when I started hearing about how bad gas was. But it's very hard for people to, especially if somebody just made an investment of $5,000 to $10,000 to do, you know, put in a new gas furnace, and they did it in the last 5 years, like us. How do you help people who've made that investment if they, in the next 10 years, need to replace their gas furnace? And is there going to be an infrastructure available? Will there be suitable alternatives at that point for people not to have gas anymore and to be able to have some kind of truly renewable heating source? And because electric heating, at least until recently, was certainly not the answer either. So what would be the answer to heat your house?
I mean, from a technology standpoint, there are things like heat pump or community and building energy that relies on energy cycling that doesn't have to originate from a fossil fuel. And so I'm not an architect or an engineer, so the depth of my knowledge and ability to go on that is pretty lean, let's say. But we do know that in Oregon, natural gas build out for domestic use is starting to like creep up really high in terms of our domestic greenhouse gas footprint. And of course, the gas industry realizes that same dynamic that you're talking about. If they build something, if they put it in the ground, it's a lot harder to take it out once it's there. It's the same with like establishing pipelines and getting easements and right-of-ways. And so the first step here is to just draw a line in the sand, no new fossil fuel infrastructure. And that means domestic gas, it means pipelines, it means gas export projects. If we can't get there, then we're basically doomed anyway.
But the question, I mean, I understand we have to stop the infrastructure, but what do you do to get people transitioning? How can people afford to transition to something that's going to be greener?
I think that's where models like the Portland Clean Energy Fund can play in, where we do need subsidies to help people transition. I think it is it can be an economic burden, particularly for low-income families. So we need to be able to have programs that can assess people's needs and help them transition to a heat pump or to a whatever. We know that the technology is there to meet our goals, at least to stop the expansion of new fossil fuel infrastructure. And so it's about finding the government will, because, you know, it was interesting, you were talking about where's the budget for this, and no one asked where's the budget for this when Trump passed a 40% tax cut on corporations.
Well, people did ask, but they didn't get a very good answer.
Yeah. I guess it wasn't seriously asked, apparently, because it was just not unanimous, but very easily passed by Congress, and similarly with our military spending. So I think there's funds for these kinds of investments to fund a transition, protecting the people who might be burdened the most. And I think that's where we just need to reevaluate where our government is spending its money.
Well, I've had lots of shows where I've had people talk about how renewable technology is here. I mean, it's really much more of a question of political will than it is technological will. And yet I feel like people can talk about it on this show, but this is not something that's becoming really mainstream understanding. So that's how do we get the word out? I mean, how do we change the conversation so people recognize that this is not something, these are not technologies we don't have? I mean, we are a lot closer with wind generation and with other things that I don't even know about than we are, for instance, with fusion or certainly carbon sequestration for coal-fired plants and things like that.
Well, that's another topic. But I guess what I would say about technology is that I want to go back to what you started the show with, which was remembering what conditions we faced with the New Deal in the 1940s, and also with World War II, actually, which might be even a more apt example, where the United States did not necessarily have the economy or the factories that were ready to produce, you know, all the, and I'm not advocating for this, but the kind of military weaponry and aviation and planes and fighter jet planes that were needed. And then in the space of 6 months, once the United States decided that this was a national priority, we were able to retool our economy to meet the needs of what our vision was, or whether it was going to the moon. I think, you know, when John F. Kennedy declared that we were going to go to the moon, these are not all things that I think are, I see your face, so I'm just, you know.
I go to the moon. It was
regardless
fun.
Regardless of, it shows that whenever we are united around a vision about what's needed, we can actually find the technology. And even if we're not currently at that space, as you're pointing out, we've seen in our own history, in very recent history, that our country's been able to make massive transformations of our economy, our manufacturing, to meet the need that we face.
Well, people have been talking about 20 years by having a Manhattan Project for confronting climate change. I mean, it's like we have, as you said, we have this history, but It's
about the political will. Right.
100% agree with that. I was lucky enough in some of my graduate school work to study history of technology. And at least in the modern world, major factors are just like, what are you investing research dollars in? And so if you're investing, which we do a lot in universities and through government research, if we're investing money in technologies that are going to yield sort of single use products for giant companies, then that's the type of technology that you're going to get. If we're investing research dollars, public research dollars, university research dollars in large social changes and the technology is going to support those, then that's the type of research that we're going to get. I mean, we have extraordinarily talented thinkers that still come to the United States from everywhere to learn in our universities. And if we have a vision and a social structure that supports people creating for the common good, then that's what we're going to get. As Connor said, we've seen this happen before. I'm also wary of war metaphors, but just in terms of scale, it's interesting to think of just like how much had to transform, or even, you know, Marshall Plan in Europe and the rebuilding of their economy and sort of how they retool. I mean, there's a lot of examples of humans being able to overcome enormous technological obstacles with willpower and creativity.
Well, I'm just thinking of all the things that we still have to talk about, and we've got no time left. So I'm thinking I'd like to have you both on the show again in a number of weeks, because some of the things I'd like to talk about is this Zenith issue with bringing oil trains again through this area, and that's a concern. Actually, Nick, do you have, there's things happening around that people can do to be involved with that.
Yeah. So just very briefly, there's a oil by rail expansion happening in the Northwest Industrial District on the west side of the Willamette River that would potentially increase tar sands rail traffic in Portland something like 400% and bring way more rail through our town. And it's dangerous for a variety of reasons, bad for the climate for a variety of reasons. There's going to be a forum at City Council on March 26th, which I guess is tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow
at 7 p.m. where folks can learn more. And you can also, if you're a listener and you want to get involved in that, you can send me directly an email and I'd be happy to plug you in. My email is nick.caleb@sustainable-economy.org. And we at CSE caucus with a variety of other groups who are interested in putting together a grassroots strategy. Always call your city councilors and your county commissioners and let them know that you're opposed to these types of projects. They've been getting inundated with calls and so far our elected officials have come up with more or less the correct stance, which is we oppose the expansions of projects like this. And to turn that opposition into legal changes or trying to stop this, we're going to need to continue to raise the pressure. So if you want to get involved, email me and otherwise just go to that forum on the 26th at City Hall and look for other opportunities because there'll be plenty.
Great. And Con, anything else people can get involved in that you're concerned about?
Oh, I didn't remember that. Nope, I don't have anything right now.
Well, what I would like to plan is like sometime in May we have both on because there's a lot of I'd like to talk more about all the fossil fuel infrastructure that we have in Portland, particularly going down Highway 30, St. Helens Road, and what people are thinking about or doing to try to deal with that because that's another real serious threat to this region.
I guess I should say that there is, if you go on our Oregon Just Transition Alliance website, we are advancing diesel regulation and also supporting the PUC reform bill. So please go on our website, opalpdx.org, or and contact us.
Great. Well, thank you both for joining us. It's been really great, and we will talk soon. We've been talking today with Nicholas Caleb, who's staff attorney with the Center for Sustainable Economy, and Con Pham, Organizing Director with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll be rerunning the interview I did last month with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. It was on the wrong time last month, but this time it'll be on at 10 o'clock. It's normal. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Van Morrison. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thanks, Barbara.
When all the dark clouds roll away, young sun begins to shine.